This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. How do you feel about redistricting? Some see it as an incredibly dull, inside baseball kind of political issue. Others think it could be the most powerful force in altering the face of American politics. As of this morning, news in Virginia of a new idea to give you a voice in redistricting. So we'll talk about it this hour. Of course, the battle over gay marriage, Medicaid, marijuana, making ends meet, both for individuals and for the federal government, also all making news. We'll get to as much of it as we can while making sure you know you are invited to bring up whatever topic political is most important to you. Our Gibson, Kumar, Roberts analysis team here to help, plus some time with awesome state political reporter Shellyann Davis. So much to get to, and we will, right after this news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. It looks like it will continue to be illegal to have sex outside of marriage in Virginia. And if you get caught, a pretty hefty fine stays in place. And you thought our elected officials only voted on boring stuff. Politics, our focus today. 888-WMRA-TALK, the easy way to remember our phone number. So, whether we get into the latest consideration of the Old Dominion so-called fornication law, the national debate over unemployment benefits, marijuana, the debt ceiling, and the state and national debates over Medicaid, same-sex marriage, mental health, or something completely different, it's largely up to you. Our first directive is to consider what you bring up when you call us at 888-967-2825. And, of course, it's never boring when we have our political analysis team with us. McClatchy News Service White House correspondent Anita Kumar, Sorensen Institute Executive Director Bob Gibson, and James Madison University political scientist Bob Roberts. Welcome all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Well, a technical note. Anita is only going to be with us until about the bottom of the hour. And then we're going to let her get back to recovering from being home ill today. And have state political reporter Shellyann Davis join us for the second half of the show. So while we have Anita, let's focus on national news for a bit.
Sure.
Anybody got any? Immigration, maybe, Anita?
Sure. We'll talk about it. There's actually news about that today. So we've been talking about immigration for a lot of months now, a lot of years probably. And for a little while here earlier this year, in the last few weeks, it looked like the House of Representatives in Washington might be willing to look at the issue and try to work with the Senate to come up with some kind of compromise. The Senate passed a bill last year that the president supports that would do a lot of a comprehensive, larger bill, but it includes finding a path to citizenship for 11 million illegal immigrants. And the House has not been a fan of that. They basically say they can't trust the administration to keep the border secure. How can they, why would they move ahead with this? But the speaker said a couple weeks ago he's willing to look at it. He had principles that he outlined about immigration and that they might try to do something. And just today he said in his news conference that it's going to be very difficult to get anything done this year, which, of course, if anyone's following this issue, it's just back and forth almost every day. Well, today it looks great. Today, tomorrow, it looks like it's never going to happen. So
I think it's important to remember what he means, nothing's going to get done. He can't get a majority of Republicans to vote for
right.
it. It can get done.
Right.
If he put on the floor the Senate bill, it would pass. All the Democrats would vote for it, most Democrats, and enough Republicans would vote for it.
When he put out his principles, things that he wanted to see happen a couple weeks ago, they were from him and the Republican leadership, but they were not from the rank and file.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of the rank and file were not too pleased with it.
No, they're absolutely opposed to their voters are absolutely opposed, a lot of them, to the idea of citizenship. And there are a lot of Republicans who are very concerned that if you do that, in the long run, it would be a gift to the Democratic Party because many of these citizens, new citizens, would vote Democratic. So I think there's also politics as part of this.
Bob Gibson, the work of the Sorensen Institute is in part getting Republicans and Democrats talking to each other. Is there a possibility in your view that there might be some movement towards some kind of compromise on immigration this year?
Well, there is common ground there, so they could do it if the political will exists. But I think the Speaker's in a tough spot. Most of his conference, most of his caucus in the House of Representatives is against the bill. So, you know, we're only a little less than 9 months away from a midterm election in the House, all 435 seats in the House, and a third of the Senate is up on the November 4th ballot. And a lot of nominations have to happen between now and then. So they're in full political mode now, and politics sort of takes over in the even-numbered years.
Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts mentioned a moment ago that some Republicans oppose getting something passed, perhaps because they think it would be such a big political win for Democrats. But on the other hand, isn't there an argument from some elements of the Republican Party that not acting on this is hurting them in the voting booth with Hispanics?
Oh, yes. There is a there reports have been made by Republican groups that have shown that they would increase their standing in the general electorate if they would reach a compromise on immigration reform. But that doesn't satisfy the base of the party. And right now, the base of the party is holding holding sway in this issue.
And Bob Roberts, I guess the point you've made here before is that for many members of the House of Representatives, they don't care in terms of how it affects the national party, because what they want to do is please the people in their district.
And we've talked about numerous times, these districts are gerrymandered. And they're very they're not reflective in terms of the way they're gerrymandered. They're not particularly diverse gerrymandering. In other words, a lot of the Republican districts have very few minorities in them. And therefore, to their constituents, winning those races will not depend upon Hispanic voters or minority voters. And therefore, they don't care. In fact, they would anger their voters, who believe that if they had their druthers, that many of these individuals would be sent back to the countries that they came from. So, due to gerrymandering, largely, the polarization in these congressional districts lead to this type of political behavior.
Well, I mentioned a few moments ago that we are up for discussing anything political that you want to offer as a suggestion, question, comment. 1-888-WMRA-TALK, the easy way to remember our phone number in all numbers, translates to 888-967-2825. I am sorry, I failed to mention that you can also find us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. But apparently regular Facebook watchers already know that, because we've got some posts on Facebook. And the first one here is from Frank, and this might be for you, Anita. Frank asking, quote, "Are we really about to see all manner of brinksmanship over the federal debt ceiling yet again?"
Well, they claim not. tomorrow is the 7th, and that's the day that the Treasury Secretary Jack Lew has said that the debt ceiling needs to be raised by. But there's always sort of a little bit of confusion on the dates when those come up. There might be an actual date, but then they can use extraordinary measures for a few weeks. So we're back at a deadline again. We had not been here in a few weeks, and they seem to be getting along. I mean, they claim that they will come up with a deal before they absolutely have to. But, you know, it's the Congress and the White House. And so they sometimes go they come past the deadline, but they'll still do it in the nick of time. And there is talk about that they, both sides, are working on something and that they would.
Yeah, what the deal talked about in the paper last couple of days was that even the Senate, the Democratic leader, in Harry Reid, was somewhat supportive of this concept that the Republicans want to restore the cuts to retired veterans who are not 65, who are below 65, that they wouldn't get the cost of living increases. And that was part of the budget deal that was reached. And that's has angered a lot of retired veterans, particularly in Virginia and other heavy veteran states. And the Speaker seemed to indicate that he might see that as something that his members might go for in return for voting for a debt ceiling expansion. But
so negotiation on the table could be, although it hasn't been announced officially yet, you put back in those old cost of living increases at the same level they used to be for military veterans into the federal budget, and we will go ahead and support an increase in the debt ceiling.
Yeah, the Speaker was saying that might be something his members would go for. And clearly, in Virginia, that would be very popular, and I would suspect that the Virginia Republican delegation would go for that. But bottom line is, the debt ceiling can pass if you put it on the floor again. I mean, we're forgetting. It's not a problem of passing. It's simply a problem. He doesn't want to put it on the floor and have it pass.
The speaker.
The speaker doesn't want to put it on the floor and not have it pass with majority Republican vote. So this is all a game, really.
Well, yeah, but Speaker John Boehner probably wants to keep his role as Speaker of the House. And if too often he goes to the Democrats in the chamber to support measures that the majority of his House members, his Republican members, don't want, doesn't he risk not keeping his job as Speaker of the House?
We thought that was the case last time, and he did.
Every single time he does that and he gets some Democratic votes, everybody says, well, it's over. He's not going to be Speaker, but he's still Speaker.
He's still Speaker.
Yeah.
In other words, it's you know, maybe that's not really true. Maybe all his members want is not to say they voted for it.
Mr. Gibson, you want to weigh in here?
Well, I wonder who his replacement would be. I mean, to beat the speaker, you have to have a speaker in waiting. And I'm not sure there is such a person yet.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So I'm not sure he's really that afraid of the – I think he just doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to have a whole series of – it embarrasses him that he can't deliver the majority of his Republicans on a bill.
Anita, it seems to me that the president of the United States, who you watch fairly regularly there at the White House, did a kind of State of the Union address recently. Anything significant coming out of that since then?
He did. I heard a lot of people say it was small potatoes. You know, there wasn't a lot in there. He is faced with, you know, he had a pretty bad year last year. A lot of things, votes didn't go his way, and he had some crisis, some issues that came up that he just sort of maybe didn't anticipate or things like that. So, you know, we were sort of eager to see what his big speech of this year would be like. And he has a theme this year, and he's calling this year a year of action. And he says he knows that Congress won't vote for some things that he wants, but while he still wants them to, he's not going to wait for them to act. Going to try to come up with his own policy proposals and implement them executive actions. But the thing is, and he does have a lot of executive powers, all presidents do, and he can do some substantial things, but some not so substantial things. So it really depends on the issue. You know, a good example is, and this is not one that he just did in the last couple weeks, but a great example that people might remember is, you know, he hasn't gotten an immigration bill through, as we were just talking about. And a couple years ago, he said he would halt deportations or slow them for Dreamers. And Dreamers are those that, you know, are coming to the United States as young children. These are illegal immigrants. They've gone to school. They want to go to college or into the military. And so he has the authority to do some of those things. But the question is really on a variety of issues. Does he have enough power to do a lot of substantial things? And I think probably the answer is no.
We have three politics watchers with us, speaking to us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the man who heads up the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson. Here with me in the Insight Studio, James Madison University political science professor Bob Roberts. And with us for only about 10 more minutes by phone, White House correspondent for the McClatchy Newspaper Group, Anita Kumar. So if you specifically want to talk to Anita, this would be a great time to talk to her. By calling us at 888-WMRA Talk. Let's go to Waynesboro. Carl, thanks for using that number and calling in your question or comment, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I have a couple real short questions here, but hopefully they might bring further discussion.
Well, give us one at a time.
Okay. As far as immigration is concerned, I think most people agree that the people that are here, most of them are hard workers and deserve to have some type of legalization. I mean, our culture needs them. They really help with our agricultural products that we have and everything. But, you know, and then they could go ahead and have some kind of pathway later. But I do think that what we have to do is to definitely keep somehow be able to control how many of the immigrants are, you know, allowed into our country. Otherwise, in 10, 15 years, we've got 12 more million. And I think, you know, there's got to be, you know, some kind of, there's got to be a give and take. Republicans give the immigration bill, make the pathway. The Democrats make sure that they put up some kind of legal protection so they can't keep coming in.
Carl, can you hang on for about a minute?
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that Bob Gibson might have some insight in response to what we just heard from you. So I'm going to give him the microphone when we get back after this short break. Our analysis panel on this edition of Virginia Insight, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, political reporter, former political reporter, and now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department, Bob Roberts. I'm Tom Graham. We still got Carl on the phone, and I'm sorry for the flashback there, Bob Gibson. Back in those days when I knew you as a political reporter, but based on that and based on your work at the Sorensen Institute today, I'm guessing you have some insight over this difference in Republican views and Democratic views on immigration that Carl was talking about.
Well, it is a perennial issue. It's an issue that comes up all the time now, and it's highly charged both emotionally and politically, and it is a good example of how the Congress is not working, because there are plenty of avenues for compromise. There are plenty of areas where the two parties could compromise, and yet the base of each party is sort of insisting on more than the other party is willing to give, so nothing happens.
Do you think the Republicans have kind of a legitimate reason to be a little bit scared here, as I think Carl was hinting at? I mean, the argument that we often hear is that the amnesty created by Ronald Reagan back in the mid-1980s did not follow up with the crackdown on illegal immigration that had been promised.
I don't know what kind of crackdown would be practical at this point. I think what we have is a workforce issue, and the workforce issue argues in favor of various types of immigration for various parts of the economy in this country that immigration is needed for. The crackdown is...
Right, I was going to say, and there are limits. There are certain numbers for each of those.
There certainly are limits, and there are various sectors of the economy that depend on this immigration, and it's not being successful in coming through for those parts of the economy, and the economy is suffering as a result. The crackdown part is political, and it is used as a wedge to keep anything from happening in the Congress, and the Congress has shown that it deserves the 10% support it gets among the American people because it's broken.
Carl, I know you had several other issues, but we're getting some other calls now. I got to make room for them. Do you have one other quick point you wanted to make?
Yeah, just real quick. You know, it's time for our leaders to put down the political infighting and actually do something that the country needs. We need to have the immigration people here. Again, they do very well with what they're needed for, and a lot of them are good citizens, and I think they deserve to be kept here, but are allowed to stay here, but there has to be a pathway that doesn't put them in front of somebody who's been trying for 10 years the legal way. You know, the usual comments. Okay,
Carl,
thanks
so much. 888-967-2825 is our phone number, and that translates to the memory tool, 888-WMRA. Talk. You can also reach us through Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. If you want to talk to our political analysts, Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts. See, there's an S at Bob Roberts' name, but not at Gibson's name. And Anita Kumar. We're going next to Stanton. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I want to echo the last caller in that I think, and I'm very considered pretty right-wing, hardcore right-wing. I'm more libertarian than Republican in my conservatism. But the vast majority of us have no problem with the immigrants and the addition to the labor force. And in fact, they're good people. We all agree on that. The sticky wicket is citizenship and voting. And I can tell you that those of us on the right side of the spectrum, if we get another amnesty that gives citizenship and voting rights to people who push themselves to the front of the line, Boehner won't survive, and I doubt the Republican Party will survive that. We are happy to have the people, but we are not going to hand over our country to people who bully themselves in and are looking for the handouts so they can send the remittances back home. I'm happy to have them, but I don't want them to have any voting privileges. If they want voting privileges, I suggest that they go back home and get in line to do it the right way. Otherwise, they can stay, live, and work, but never vote.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting position. I clearly, a lot of very conservative Republicans believe that. But we have to remember through much of American history that we had open immigration and that we didn't put barriers to voting for Italians, Irish.
That was 100 years ago.
I agree it was 100 years ago. but in a sense that they came over for the same reason immigrants are coming over now.
It's not bigotry, sir.
I'm just saying. I'm not saying that it's not bigotry. I'm just saying that the reason they came over was to fill the job needs. These immigrants are coming over to fill the job needs, and therefore, why treat them differently? Why treat them differently than a previous generation of immigrants? Why not give them the right to vote when we give previous generations of immigrants the right to vote? And the reason is it might change the political balance in this country, because right now the Republican Party is not liked by many Hispanics because of the positions they've taken on large numbers of issues. So from a practical political position, you're right. It wouldn't theoretically help the Republican Party right now.
But there is some irony, though,
yeah.
Because Alex says that he's quite conservative, although he did call himself a libertarian conservative. There are many social conservatives who make the argument that the strong Catholicism among many Hispanics would make them a better fit on social conservative issues with the Republican Party. I'm just going to leave it there for now because we do have some other calls.
Okay.
Alex, you got us thinking. Thank you so much for doing that. 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Our phone number next to Mount Sydney. Walter, thank you for joining us. I understand you're probably going to have the final question for Anita before she leaves us this afternoon.
Oh, okay, good. Do you want me to speak? Or
yeah, yes? Go right ahead.
Okay. Whatever happened, I remember in the 90s, Congress, there was a little hoopla. They were talking about term limits for members of Congress. Whatever happened with that? Because I'll tell you, they have gotten so little done the last decade. Seems like they're only concerned with protecting their own jobs. That term limits is a way to get them to maybe do something. And they've done so little, I think they should pay back half of their salaries because they don't really do anything. I'll wait for your reply.
Anita, when's the last time you heard somebody in D.C. talking about term limits?
All the time, but not members of Congress. I assume that they look at that from time to time, but it doesn't go anywhere because Congress has to approve it. So I don't remember that time in the 90s, but I'm sure, how it is. It's people push the bill, and then it doesn't go anywhere. I think it's been more, even more recently, even now, I think there's some that have been pushing it. But, I mean, it just doesn't have the popularity. It doesn't have the support.
Campaign finance reform
and term limits are the things that they always say that they want to change, but then they never do.
Bob Gibson, Anita is the youngster among our panel. Do you remember that time in the 90s?
We have had periodic discussions of term limits, and it's a state-by-state thing as well. The problem with term limits is that if not everybody does it, you're disadvantaging certain electorates and not others. And if you have term limits, you're basically giving power that had gone to elected officials to other officials who may not be elected. So there are many reasons that term limits is a controversial solution to the problem of incumbency never being over.
Walter, thank you so very much for your call.
Boy, there is a theme here, though. Everybody wants Congress to do something.
And then when they do something, not everybody is happy about it.
All right.
Joining us now by phone is the longtime state political reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Shelley and Davis. Great to have you back on the Inside Airwaves.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
And Anita's going to leave us soon. I didn't know if you'd heard this yet, Shelley, but Anita's actually not feeling very well today.
Yes, thank you for sharing that with everyone.
I'm sorry to hear it.
And she was kind enough to stay with us for half an hour, but we're going to let her go, get some rest. But I figured you guys might want to say hi to each other since you spent all those years working right next door to each other.
Hi.
Hello.
Oh, and Tom called you awesome earlier.
Oh, that's very nice of him.
Yeah. So,
just
have
being
a good
truthful.
Discussion on the General Assembly.
Anita, thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Shelley, we probably got to talk with you about redistricting, don't we?
Sure. So if that's
you were waiting for me to actually ask a question.
I was.
So, all right, this morning's headline in the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, General Assembly, bill would give voters a voice in redistricting. Byline, Shelley and Davis.
Yes. The Senate passed that yesterday, and what it would do is it calls for a referendum, which Virginia rarely uses. Some states do a lot of referendums, but Virginia does not so much. But it would put to voters in the fall a question of whether they want to have a bipartisan redistricting commission or not. And that is not something Virginia has now. As you know, the legislators themselves redraw their district lines every 10 years after the census. And, I mean, both parties do it. They draw them to benefit themselves. So the idea of a bipartisan, non-legislative group is popular among a lot of people, but not so much among the legislators. The Senate passed it, but I would not hold out a whole lot of hope of that passing through the House.
Yeah, I really doubt it has any legs in the House of Delegates at all. And because the gerrymandering is the lifeblood of politics in this country. A lot of states, except for Iowa, Iowa has a commission, but it's little likelihood of ever passing in this state right now.
Well, Bob Gibson, I don't remember exactly when it was, but sometime in the past couple of months when you were on the panel, you pointed out that we now have two Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate representing statewide Virginia. We have a governor, a lieutenant governor, and an attorney general who all were elected as Democrats in statewide elections. We have a state Senate that split evenly 20-20, but in the House of Delegates, we have twice as many Republicans as we have Democrats. So how does that happen?
Well, one way it happens is through redistricting, because the Republican majority can draw districts to protect itself, and they've done so rather effectively. There were only about 10 seats in the House of Delegates last November that were seriously competitive in the November elections. So basically, the House Republicans see themselves as protecting their majority through the redistricting process. The irony is that if this bill were to pass and if there were an independent commission to handle redistricting, their majority probably would not go away. Their majority would probably lose a few seats, but probably not go away. So you'd have districts that would make more sense to the voters. Right now, voters don't know what district they're in. Districts are drawn all over the map in strange places so that they don't correspond with communities very well. Albemarle County has four different members of the House of Delegates representing Albemarle, one of whom lives 70 miles out of Albemarle. Lynchburg has four different representatives representing Lynchburg in the House of Delegates, and they don't live all near Lynchburg. So you have districts that don't make sense to voters now. If they were made more community-minded and more compact, you would probably not see a great change in the numbers of Republican seats. You would have district delegates who would actually represent their community better, because the community would know who their representative was, and it would make more sense on the map.
But the ideology of those delegates in those districts would change.
Right now you have districts where they're so Republican in nature or so Democratic in nature that only a hardcore base-pleasing Republican or only a hardcore base-pleasing Democrat is going to win the nomination to represent that district.
And those interest groups who are like that agenda being pursued by their Republican delegates or their Democratic delegates have no interest in that. They want their ideology. So in a sense, that makes it even more difficult, because you have lots of different interest groups who benefit from having very ideologically drawn districts.
Shelley, did I hear you say that this push for a referendum that passed overwhelmingly in the Virginia State Senate, that this would be a non-binding referendum? It simply would say to voters, do you like the idea of having a nonpartisan redistricting commission?
Right. Yes. It's not binding. And so, yeah, you're right. It pretty much says, hey, would you like this? And if the voters say yes, the legislature can still say, well, that's nice to know, and we'll keep doing it the way we're doing it.
But if you're only going to ask voters for their opinion, what argument is there going to be in the House for voting against this, where it seems like that's what they're going to do?
It's to be put pressure on the legislators.
Yeah, like any poll. Yeah.
It's like a poll to put pressure on them. But the pressure is non-existent, because we do not have initiative and referendum in Virginia.
When was the last time we had an advisory referendum in Virginia?
I don't remember.
I think we had one back in the 60s, perhaps on the lottery.
Miller thought it was 100 years ago to do a referendum like he was talking about.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
He was the senator that proposed it?
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
I think we had one about massive resistance, if I remember, back in the mid-50s. I may be wrong.
Okay, so if you just joined us, politics is our focus on this edition of Virginia Insight, and now our analysis panel is made up of Fredericksburg Freelance Star newspaper reporter Shelley Ann Davis, former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department's Bob Roberts. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and we do have phone lines open for any topic political. 888-WMRA-TALK, translates to 888-967-2825. You can also reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this from Heidi on the Facebook page. Heidi saying she thinks it would be awesome, all caps, many exclamation points. Awesome if Virginia's General Assembly would even be discussing legalization of marijuana. Heidi's further comment, quote, I am very hopeful that we will see an end to the futile war on drugs in my lifetime. Is there any discussion of marijuana in this year's General Assembly
session? I believe somebody actually had a bill to remove what little provision Virginia has for medical marijuana. I think that was Bob Marshall, although I'd have to look it up. That is not something that's under discussion at the moment. We are not going to be like Colorado anytime soon.
So nobody's been particularly influenced by the president's remarks of a few weeks ago that he thinks marijuana is no worse than alcohol.
No, I think it Virginia still has this view that drug use, marijuana in particular, is very different than alcohol. The president has taken a very different position. A lot of experts are saying that marijuana is not a gateway drug. Right now, for example, that prescription painkillers has become the gateway drug to, let's say, heroin. But in a sense that Virginia, that the members of the Virginia General Assembly are not seemingly inclined to follow the example of Colorado.
Let's go next to Harrisonburg. Jim, thanks for calling in here on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
I would like to hear again articulated the arguments that term limits are not a good idea. I think that is a debate that we need to hold. And actually, I'm in favor of term limits. I only see that as a very selfish item that feeds the legislature's personal interests rather than the public. So I would like to hear.
Okay, Jim, hold on a second. I think Bob Gibson didn't take a stand on this, but he was representing what some people say about what the problem with term limits is. Bob, you want to repeat that?
Well, if you have a situation where some states' representatives are term limited and others aren't, then you have a situation where some are allowed to be powerful and some never gain the seniority to be powerful at the same level. That's one argument against it. Virginia has term limits. We term limit our governor to one term. We're the only state that does that. The Virginia governor is the only governor in the state in the country that can't run for a second term. He can sit out a term and run for a term 4 years later, but that's
cannot
the only term limit.
Cannot run consecutively. Yeah.
Cannot run consecutively. So Virginia does have a term limit. We term limit our governor. We don't term limit anybody else.
The other thing that I recall you saying, I think, Bob, was that one argument is that if you term limit elected legislators, like members of Congress.
Then it's the staff or the bureaucracy that gets the power.
Right.
If the legislatures aren't staffed with people who actually know after a number of terms where the bodies are buried.
And finally, term limits wouldn't deal with the issue of gerrymandering. In other words, if you have...
Well, that's true. It wouldn't deal with gerrymandering, but gerrymandering is something that's a standalone problem. I'm not even concerned so much with the absence of term limits in the state of Virginia. I'm more concerned nationally, and I think that would...
Jim, I'm sorry we're about to hit the break, but you've raised a point that's been fascinating to listen to, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are some other people listening who have opinions, and they are welcome to share them as well. You know what we haven't gotten to yet, though, is a raging debate that's building in Virginia over gay marriage.
Right.
And we'll explain some of why that debate has gotten so much oomph in the last few days when we get back. We have three politics watchers with us, speaking to us from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, the man who heads up the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Gibson. Here with me in the Insight Studio, James Madison University political science professor, Bob Roberts. And speaking to us by phone, Virginia politics reporter for the freelance Star newspaper, Shelley Davis. Who wants to go first on same-sex marriage?
I will. We have two court cases, one in Harrisonburg, which has been in progress since August. We have a new court case that was argued earlier this week in Norfolk, both dealing with the same issue, whether the Virginia's 2006 constitutional amendment defining marriage is only between a man and woman is constitutional under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And both judges are proceeding with the cases. We could have decisions fairly quickly, apparently to the Norfolk judge who heard it fairly recently, and according to the Harrisburg federal judge who also heard it fairly recently. And they will have to make a decision whether it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution, like we've seen a number of federal court judges across the country. So Virginia could be at the forefront of that debate in terms of whether Virginia becomes a state that has same-sex marriage.
Shelley, have you been hearing much from state lawmakers on this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They have many opinions about this. In fact, the House of Delegates last week passed a bill that would allow state legislators to, I guess, have standing to get involved themselves in a lawsuit when the Attorney General does not defend a law of Virginia, because their big argument is that Herring should be defending Virginia's same-sex marriage law because it is a Virginia law, whether he agrees with it or not.
Next to Cumberland, Matthew, thanks for joining us. I understand you have a question or comment on this very subject.
Yes, sir, I do. Virginia citizens have already voted on this, and we voted against it. And now one person is trying to change everybody's views on this, or to put themselves before all of Virginia. It was decided democratically.
The fact remains that a attorney general, this is my personal opinion, an attorney general has a responsibility if he believes the law is unconstitutional not to support it. We've had numerous incidents in Virginia history where we've had clearly unconstitutional laws enforced in this state. And the attorney generals have defended those laws to the bitter end and lost. And I think this attorney general has taken a fairly principled stand saying, I'm not going to be like those attorney generals in the past that have taken positions that they felt were unconstitutional.
Is it reasonable for people like Matthew
mm-hmm.
to say, how principled is it that this attorney general did not make a big issue of this during the campaign and promise that once he became attorney general, he would not support Virginia's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage?
He in a sense, what happened was when he was a senator, he voted for the ban.
He really danced around the issue in the campaign.
No, I'm going to say he danced.
This was in no way a referendum.
I'm not sure it was. We raised this question during the campaign. It was raised by some reporters during the campaign. I don't think he was asked specifically what he would do. I don't think anyone asked him what would happen if these cases went to the courts.
Shelley, do you want to be the arbitrator here?
No, I don't. I mean, as you can see, there's a lot of questions about interpretation of what law is and what somebody should be doing. And you know, I do not feel qualified to.
I just was wondering the degree to which the Richmond Press Corps had a sense of Mr. Herring's promises on this issue during the campaign.
I don't think he was at. In fact, there will be people who have standing to challenge this, according to fairly good legal interpretations. The clerk of the court is a constitutional officer in Virginia, and therefore the clerk of the court in Stanton and the clerk of the court in Norfolk probably has standing. They have their own lawyers right now, probably have standing to challenge this.
Well, Bob Gibson, Matthew raises the point that this was passed into law by voters. Actually, voters had to go to the polls 2 years in a row to make this a constitutional amendment. I think
voters didn't. Voters voted in 2006 to make it a constitutional amendment. The legislature did 2 years in a row.
I apologize. Yeah. That's right. That's the procedure.
2006.
So there was considerable talk over this over a couple-year period. But what's constitutional sometimes seems to be connected to changing opinion. And is it accurate to say in the 8 years since this became a part of Virginia's constitution that national opinion and even Virginia opinion on same-sex marriage has changed significantly?
Even in Virginia, the polls are showing a change in opinion based on recent surveys that show that a majority of Virginians or a plurality of Virginians favor same-sex marriage, where 2 or 3 years ago they did not. So the Attorney General is looking at the law, looking at the Constitution, and looking at the polls, I'm sure. You know, in the 1960s in Virginia, it was illegal for a black to marry a white person, a white person to marry a black person. and the state defended that law, and the state lost in the Loving versus Virginia case. And that case was brought up in the arguments in this case, and I think the Supreme Court will decide within half a year whether Virginia is going in the right direction on this or not.
Matthew, thanks so much for your call. Former newspaper reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, one of our guests, still newspaper reporter at the state capitol for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Shelley and Davis with us by phone, and here in the Insight studio from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department's Bob Roberts. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We got a few minutes left to take a call on anything political. If you've got a question or comment, do give us a call at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Okay, I don't know how to put this gently. Let me ease into this, Shelley. And I don't know that you knew this about me, but I was once married. And I have not been for many years now. And I think it's safe to say that I have not, to my knowledge, broken any Virginia laws in many years. However, there are some people who are going to be maybe surprised to know that if they're not married and they're having sex, they are still breaking the law in Virginia. And action was taken in the General Assembly this week that's going to keep it that way.
Yeah. there was a bill up to sort of repeal Virginia's language regarding fornication laws, which are on the books and have been there a very long time, and I believe I heard lawyers arguing that they are essentially unconstitutional and rarely enforced unless they are brought up, like in the course of a divorce or, you know, adultery issue in the courts. But while that may sound like a, you know, exciting and sexy issue, the committee, I think a House Courts of Justice subcommittee yesterday managed to make even that boring by getting into talk about the Code Commission, and eventually they decided that they would let the Code Commission look at this and decide how to properly, get that language out of the code.
Yeah, there was in the Virginia pilot analysis of this effort to get rid of Virginia's anti-fornication law, and the standard at currently is, I guess, it's a $250 fine for each offense. I'm not even going to imagine what that means. But that in the pilot story, it said that there were 8 convictions under this law in Virginia last year.
Yeah,
that
but
that was said in the committee yesterday. Yeah,
yeah, but they were convictions primarily, if you read the article, not for what I call a normal adult relationship, which would be considered federal courts have ruled it cannot be enforced against a consenting couple. They've been used against incest cases, against other individuals.
You know, I read the article,
yeah,
and it didn't qualify that way. What it said was that those who are arguing against getting rid,
right,
of what somebody sees, some people see as an ancient morality,
correct,
standard.
Correct.
Those who say, no, we need to keep this standard,
yeah,
is so that we can use it in certain kinds of cases.
Right.
But I don't know, Shelley, did you hear qualifications of who those people were who were unfortunately convicted last year?
I did not. I was not writing on it, so I was maybe not paying quite as close attention as the
but
okay,
were.
Well, let's switch to a completely different issue because I know Shelley is going to have something to say about this. This is on our Facebook page from Sarah, who says, I read where there are efforts underway to change Virginia's standards of learning for some school students. Can you describe more of what's going on here?
Yeah, there are bills. One just passed out of the House Education Committee yesterday, so it'll be on the floor shortly, that would reduce the number of standards of learning tests, the SOL tests that students take. A number of lawmakers say that while the SOLs were a great accountability measure when they started out, it's become a situation where teachers have to teach to the test a lot, that it takes up a lot of time. Students aren't necessarily learning critical thinking skills. They're learning more rote memorization. So the effort is to sort of reduce some of those tests, especially in the lower grades, like 3 and 5, and keep tests that focus on like reading and math skills, but maybe wait a little bit longer for history and science SOLs. That's at least in the House bill. I'm more familiar with that one at this point than the Senate side. So there are bills on each side sort of working their way through. And then there are other lawmakers who say, you know, why would you get rid of these tests? you know, they're a good assessment tool, they're a good accountability measure, and why are we getting rid of them?
Do you have a sense of where the momentum is?
I would say the momentum is with the reform. I know the governor has spoken about SOL reform. I know that the bills, at least on the House side, come from House Republicans who hold the majority. And I know that, you know, they're endorsed by the Republican leadership in the House, so I would imagine those will go through. And I don't get any sense of strong opposition on the Senate side. The people who I've heard speak about it on the Senate side were not, you know, there weren't that many of them. So I think bills have actually passed on the Senate side, although I would have to look that up to be sure.
Sarah, thanks for that great question. Hey, Bob Gibson, Frank Wolf in Congress for a long time. In fact, is he Virginia's senior member of our congressional delegation?
I believe he is, and I think after about 15 terms, he is hanging it up at the end of this year.
And his district stretches from Northern Virginia into the Shenandoah Valley, so he represents some people in our listening area. Lots of movement on who's going to try to replace him?
Well, there is a Republican favorite. Delegate Barbara Comstock of McLean is the clear favorite on the Republican side, and it is a Republican-leaning district in the 10th. So she is the early favorite to succeed Congressman Wolf, but there are many Republicans interested in the seat. Dick Black he announced, actually, and then two or three days later he pulled out of the race because he would have jeopardized, had he lost his seat in Loudoun County, the 2020 split in the Senate. His colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle prevailed upon him to
stay in the Senate with us so that we don't
stay in the Senate of Virginia rather than run for Congress. So it looks like Barbara Comstock will have a contest against several lesser-known Republicans in the 10th. And there's a gentleman named Faust, who's a Fairfax County supervisor, who has the odds-on lead for the Democratic nomination in the 10th, and it should be an interesting race. But the Republicans are clearly favored. There's another seat in Northern Virginia, the 8th, where Jim Moran has been in almost as long
Democrat.
As Frank Wolf, a Democrat this time, and it's the most Democratic district in the state other than the 3rd, the minority district in the 3rd. So there are many, many Democrats from Arlington and Alexandria and Fairfax who are running for the 8th district nomination, and one of them is likely to become the next congressman succeeding Jim Moran.
Shelley and Davis there in the state capitol, Bob Gibson mentioning that Republicans wanted to keep their 2020 even split in the state Senate, but based on what's happened in the past few days, that hasn't done them much good.
What are you asking
well,
about?
Well, the fact that the Democrats have grabbed power, according to the Republicans, by having the Democratic lieutenant governor vote with them to reorganize.
Yes, they grabbed power in exactly the way that Republicans grabbed power 2 years ago.
Shocking. It's shocking.
It's shocking. Yes. Oh, I know. Yes, so when Democrats won the two special elections for the Senate seats, keeping it at 2020, and Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam is a Democrat, whereas 2 years ago the Lieutenant Governor was Bill Bowling and he was a Republican. So now Democrats are in power in the Senate, and they have reorganized committees. They have made themselves chairman of all the committees, and they have changed some of the rules as well, which Republicans have been very angry about, particularly a rule change that says that if a Senate bill is substantially amended by the House, it can be sent to the Rules Committee instead of straight back to the floor. And that is the result of the bill a couple of years ago that created the new restrictions for abortion clinics.
Correct.
And that was done by amending a Senate bill in the House and then sending it back, bypassing a committee that probably would have killed it and getting it to the full Senate.
So in some ways, this gives the Democratic chairman of one state Senate committee powers somewhat similar to the Speaker of the House and the House of Delegates.
Probably. I mean, it's hard to say exactly how it would work because we haven't seen it work yet.
Right.
And the Democrats swear that it would not be used frequently, that it would only be used in very egregious circumstances. So I think on that one, we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Amazing how much one side is upset when 2 years later the other side does what they did. So we got 30 seconds left, just enough time for you to tell us the latest on the battle over Medicaid expansion, Shelley.
That is an ongoing and probably the biggest fight of this session. Since House Republicans do not want to expand, Democrats do want to expand, and some Senate Republicans want to expand. So I think what you're going to see is that fight sort of being done through the state budget. I think you will see some form of expansion or a coverage extension in the Senate budget, and that when they negotiate that towards the end of the session, I think we could wind up in an extended session while they fight about Medicaid expansion.
Where you have 20-20 votes and the lieutenant governor cannot vote.
Cannot vote on budget. That's correct.
Right. Cannot vote on budget.
Bob Gibson, you got 10 seconds on this before we leave?
Well, as Shelley noted, there are Republicans in the Senate who favor expanding Medicaid. So I think the Senate budget will contain it, the House budget will not, and goodness knows where they will end up.
That's right.
Our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, Shelley Ann Davis, State Capitol Reporter for the Fredericksburg Free Lance Star, as well as earlier in the broadcast, McClatchy News Service White House Correspondent Anita Kumar. Gang, thanks so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward, Bob Levicky, Dan Easley. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find postings of Virginia Insight on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about our guests. Thanks for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. As Mr. Gibson says, goodness knows what's going to happen next, but we sure do hope we can get some more insight in soon.